Listening to Back in the USSR.
Да здравствует 60-я годовщина Великой Октябрьской социалистической революции. Да здравствует героический советский народ и его доблестные вооруженные силы. Слава Коммунистической партии Советского Союза, руководящей и направляющей силе советского общества. Ура!
Welcome back in the USSR, comrades and friends. This is Siegfried, and thank you for joining me here on CFRU so very late on this Monday evening. This episode of the show is going to be a little different. Last week, my first show in this new time slot, 11 p.m. Monday nights, I talked about Marxism-Leninism, self-determination, and how essential it is for anyone who calls themselves a socialist or communist to stand in solidarity with the anti-colonial struggles of indigenous people. Whether in the struggle against the Muskrat Falls Dam project here in Canada, which threatens to destroy an entire way of life, or against the Mauna Kea Super Telescope in Hawaii, or really anywhere else in the world, and how struggles for self-determination intersect with struggles around the environment and with class struggle itself. Communists and socialists fight against capitalism, colonialism, and imperialism, the forces that oppress and exploit working class and downtrodden peoples the world over, and standing with indigenous people defending their ancestral lands from colonial takeover and capitalist plunder is a massive part of that, especially in a settler colonial country like Canada, you know, where genocide is an ongoing reality. You know, we stand against the same enemies all over the world and are ultimately part of the same global struggle for liberation. Now, that understanding of the world forms a major part of who I am. Otherwise, I wouldn't be here doing this show. And naturally, it's going to affect the different aspects of my life. The people I associate with, the organizations I'm part of, the interests I have, the books I read, and especially what I choose to write. I am a writer. I am currently working on my first novel. And although it may come as a surprise to some of you, that novel actually is dark fantasy. And I write mainly within the fantasy genre. Novel's actually, it's on second draft now, so, you know, I've done the first draft, I've done, like, the real heavy lifting. And the reason why that might come as a surprise, you know, that my novel is dark fantasy, why it might come as a surprise is because the broad categories of revolutionary and fantasy nerd have been rarely known to mix. But nevertheless, I'm living proof that it can and does happen. Another reason why people might be surprised that a guy like me would write fantasy is that fantasy has traditionally, you know, I mean, if you know about the history of fantasy, fantasy as a genre has traditionally been very conservative. Very conservative. It effectively originated in the European fairy tales and romantic fiction of the early 19th century, which explicitly rejected the societal upheaval of the Industrial Revolution and painted an idealized pastoral picture of a pre-modern medieval world in which everyone was happy, everyone knew their place, kings and queens were benevolent, the lines between good and evil were clearly defined, and everything was, in a word, simpler. Does any of that sound familiar? Right-wing political rhetoric has remained remarkably consistent in many ways over the past few hundred years. You know, you have this nostalgia, you know, for this idealized portrait of the past which never actually existed. And of course, there's no room in J.R.R. Tolkien or C.S. Lewis or Lord Dunsany or Arthur Machen for the downtrodden peasant or the exploited worker or the slave fighting for freedom, or the colonized person fighting for liberation, or the woman fighting for control over her own body, or anyone who is gay, queer, lesbian, trans, etc. And frankly, there's also no room for the real history of medieval Europe in the extremely Eurocentric fantasy worlds created by these authors, by these early fantasy authors. In short, fantasy emerged as a kind of right-wing literary backlash against progressive change in the 19th century. And of course, fantasy hasn't stayed the same. You know, 21st century fantasy is far more diverse and less confined than it was in the 19th and early 20th centuries. But a lot of the central themes of the genre remain. You know, you'll notice that Game of Thrones is not about revolutionary change or the creation of a new society in the place of a thoroughly oppressive and rotten feudal order that is tearing itself apart and threatening to take everyone else down with it. No, it's ultimately about restoring the, quote, rightful rulers of Westeros, you know, House Targaryen, to the Iron Throne in King's Landing. That's what the whole series is about. It's the restoration of a dynasty, you know, that's going to come back and claim its rightful throne. You know, just as in Tolkien's The Return of the King, the true king is going to come back and restore order and make everything right again, you know, in the end. You know, it's a very conservative message. Even if Dany Targaryen, you know, the mother of dragons, is a woman, unlike Aragorn, it's still a very conservative political agenda going on in Game of Thrones. And even when progressive writers, you know, people who really want to push the envelope, write fantasy, they can, and she's actually admitted to this, fall into a similar pattern. I mean, Ursula Le Guin's Earthsea trilogy, you know, The Wizard of Earthsea, even though she does things like make the main inhabitants of her world, you know, black and brown and tries to move away from certain Eurocentric themes, You know, the series is ultimately about the restoration of a monarchy through the efforts of the exceptional young wizard Ged. You know, that's basically what it's about. And she's, of course, admitted that this, like, fundamentally, the Wizard of Earthsea and the whole Earthsea series is not that radical. And she almost wishes she could go back and, you know, change certain things, you know, seeing she wrote that relatively early in her career. And this conservative theme of restoration and the idealization of feudalism, European feudalism in particular, which gave George R.R. Martin credit, you know, to give him credit, he does at least expose some of feudalism's brutalities, you know, even though, like, in Game of Thrones, it seems like, you know, you have bad aristocrats and good aristocrats, and, like, you know, it's just because they're bad that they do these things, it's not because they're aristocrats. But nonetheless, okay, he does expose some of feudalism's feudal European brutality, you know. And, but this conservative theme of the restoration and idealization of feudalism is what the British fantasy writer Michael Moorcock challenged in the 1960s, you know, when he identified it with Tory-style conservative politics. And of course, Tolkien and C.S. Lewis were British Tories, as well as hardcore Christians, and like Lord Dunsany before them, were supporters of the British Empire. But Michael Moorcock's response to this, you know, Michael Moorcock is a relatively progressive fantasy writer coming in the 1960s when everything's, you know, old assumptions are being questioned. You know, this is also when Ursula Le Guin came in and started challenging aspects of the fantasy genre in the United States. And Moorcock was doing that in the UK. Moorcock's response to this, you know, response to this traditional conservative themes in, within fantasy. And, you know, more modern authors like Neil Gaiman have largely followed his lead on this. His response was existential experience rather than class struggle. You know, Michael Moorcock's fantasy worlds are far more morally ambiguous. His heroes, like Elric of Melnibone, are more dynamic, and they're more like social critics as they move through the flawed, imperfect, and even horrific societies that they inhabit. And at least in some of Michael Moorcock's stories, that includes the UK under Margaret Thatcher, by the way. But while Moorcock isn't interested in restoration, or indulging in conservative fantasies about an idealized past that never was, he also doesn't allow room for radical change in his books, you know, in his novels and his short stories. I've read quite a lot of his work recently, you know, especially his short stories, and they're all about the experience of the central character, the existential crises that he undergoes and, like, his experience living in a particular society. But there's no collective action, no mobilization of oppressed people to change their circumstances. There's no social movements. People don't organize to fight back against elites and exploiters. The stories are all very individualistic and personal. And that, to me, is the notable characteristic of fantasy writers that have, you know, challenged the dominant narrative in the genre. You know, like, they challenge the conservative grand narratives about the return of the king, but they do so not by building new narratives. You know, not by building new overall narratives, but by retreating into individual personal experience. You know, like, moving from the big to the small. Like, that's really what they do. And that's not enough. And I think this clip from the beginning of Michael Parenti's talk, entitled Rambo and the Swarthy Hordes, about Hollywood propaganda, is enough to explain why Michael Moorcock's position with regard to the fantasy genre, you know, where he challenges, you know, the conservative dominant narrative by retreating into personal experience, why Michael Moorcock's position is inadequate. So this is Michael Parenti. Please stay tuned to Back in the USSR.
I want to today give attention to the other side of the media, not the news media, but the entertainment media, because the entertainment media consumes a much larger share of the viewing time of most Americans than do the news programs. And I thought I would call this book something like The Hidden Political Images of the Entertainment Media. And then as I thought about it, I said, well, what's so hidden about it? It's rather blatant. And what I looked at are Hollywood films, That's what I'm studying. Hollywood films and TV dramas, TV miniseries, teleplays, and the like. What I find is a real abundance of images and ideologies, ones that are essentially supportive of imperialism, anti-communism, capitalism, racism, sexism, militarism, say militarism twice, militarism, authoritarian violence, vigilantism, and anti-working class attitudes. More specifically, I found these kinds of themes. Individual heroics predominate over collective action. There's almost no collective action. There's almost no story or drama where the people organize together and do something for themselves. I mean, there are one or two exceptions. When they do, when there is collective action, they're usually led by some hero who has to spur them on and really do the whole thing himself. Free enterprise is the best economic system in the world. That's a message which is not necessarily telegraphed so much as it is presumed. Certainly, there's nothing positive ever uttered about alternative systems in the entertainment media. Private monetary gain is a central and worthy objective of life, although those who are too wickedly greedy, the Dynasty guys and Dallas fellows, they can meet with disapproval. Sometimes business characters are insensitive to other people's needs because they're so busy with their business activities, but when properly apprised of the problems and such, they are suddenly capable of legendary acts of generosity, which I've never seen in real life, but I see on television dramas say, the kid needs the house, give it to him. They give him to give it to, I'll give the factory to Joe, he's a good guy, and all that sort of thing. Workers are beer guzzling, regular Joes, I mean, good natured and all that, but really not very bright, incapable. If I was to say any one consistent stereotype I've seen about how blue collar people are portrayed in the media, with the exception of certain films, by the way, everything I say, there are a few notable exceptions, with the exception of a film like Silkwood or A Matter of Sex, a few others, they're almost always incapable of leadership and of acting as agents of their own lives. One wonders really where labor unions came from. Labor unions are always up to not much good. They're rather insensitive to the needs of workers. Some years back, there was a TV program, Archie Bunker, All in the Family, which was supposedly against various forms of bigotry. And while it came out against the bigot, who was Archie Bunker, and made a little message statement against bigotry, every program practiced a bigotry of its own by portraying the working person as this goof and goon, and one of the big laugh lines in All in the Family was when Archie Bunker mispronounced a word, committed a malapropism, and the canned laughter would come on. That's not funny. There's nothing funny when somebody mispronounces a word. I mean, all you're saying is that he hasn't had the opportunity to have the education that some other people have had. But class bigotry is a very common form of bigotry, and it remains totally unchallenged, unlike gender bigotry or race bigotry, which at least is challenged today. The practices and forms of class bigotry go on in abundance in the media and remain unchallenged. Affluent professionals in almost all programs are considered much more interesting than blue-collar or ordinary service workers. There are many more of them as principal characters. Women and ethnic minorities are really not as capable, effective, or interesting as white males. Cop shows, the police and everyone else should be given a freer hand in combating the large criminal element in America, using generous applications of force and violence without too much attention to constitutional rights. In fact, in any number of cop shows, the cop will get up and talk about that Constitution isn't going to protect you, it's only me with my gun, and the hell with the Constitution. The ills of society are caused by individual malfactors and not by anything in the socioeconomic system. No. There are some unworthy persons in our established institutions, but they are eventually dealt with and set straight for the most part. U.S. military force is directed only toward laudable goals, or more often the goals are not even stated. It's just assumed that we've got to win this one. Nothing said about what kind of interests are involved. I mean, after all, why are people doing all this fighting and killing? It's a question that remains largely unstated. Western industrial and military might, especially the U.S.'s, has been a civilizing force for the benefit of backward peoples throughout the Third World. The United States and the entire Western world have long been threatened from abroad by foreign aggressors, such as the Russians, communist terrorists, Arab terrorists, and generally the swarthy hordes of less developed peoples. Those are, I would say, some of the general themes that come up again and again in any number of movies. And the last one is the one I want to focus on today. It's the paradigm of the wagon train versus the swarthy hordes, first enunciated very well by a marvelous article by Tom Engelhart in the Bulletin of Atomic Scientists. It could be happening in the American Wild West. It could be in the Amazon jungle, the North African desert, the Sudan, the Transvaal, the South Pacific jungles, or Indochina. The scene is generally the same. There's a fort, or an encampment, or a wagon train. And inside that encampment are the human beings. They're white. They're human. They're warm, they're attractive, they talk, and they're nice. Outside come the swarthy hordes, the savages. They can be Indians, they could be Bushmen, they can be Arabs on camels and horses or whatever else. And they are the subhumans, and they are attacking the human beings. And the wagons form their circle, and the human beings know what to do. They level their guns and they begin to knock off, shoot, and kill these screaming savages who attack them. Why do the swarthy hordes attack the white people? You don't know. They never tell you. Is it to protect their lands? Is it to protect their herds? Is it to protect their villages and their towns and their families and their children? No, it's just because they like to do that. That's their thing. They like to attack. And so they have to be killed. And by the way, it's not even bravery that they manifest as they charge in great numbers and get cut down in horrible numbers. This is not even bravery, although similar acts by whites would be portrayed as heroic. This itself is portrayed as a manifestation of the swarthy hordes, their fanatic, crazed way of wanting to bloodlust. Now, the trouble with this paradigm is that it turns the history of the last 400 years on its head. That it reverses the roles of usurper and usurped. It reverses the roles of victim and victimizer. It reverses the roles of those who were massacred and those who were doing the massacring. It was the European and North American civilizers, so-called, who went in there and destroyed the villages and destroyed their industries and destroyed their townships. Read Engels on North Africa, what happened to the Arabs and Berbers, and when he goes in and describes the beautiful towns with the fine, hard stone and plaster buildings and their woolen industries and their mining industries and their arts and crafts and all that, and then read the description of the French troops coming in and systematically destroying it and killing every man, woman, and child. Read about how the Germans went into South Africa and killed the Herero tribe. 80,000 people, they killed 60,000 of them, and the other 20,000 they used as slave labor in their minds. Read Mark Twain's angry, raging comments about King Leopold of Belgium, calling him a mad dog and what he did to the innocent, unoffending people of the Congo, taking them and enslaving them, a million of them a year dying in the mines in the Congo. That's what the history's about. That's what John Wayne is about. And what these films do is they reverse that history, stand it on its head. They do what Joseph Goebbels said. They give you a big lie, and they embellish it, and they make you root for the guys in the wagon train.
You're listening to Back in the USSR here on 93.3 FM CFRU. That was a clip from Michael Parenti's talk, Rambo and the Swarthy Hordes. And everything Michael Parenti talks about there is present in the literary world as well. And needs to be challenged just as forcefully. And that includes in the fantasy genre as well. You know, all that propaganda, you know, that you see in Hollywood, you know, that's definitely present in literature as well. You know, I grew up on Tolkien. The Hobbit, The Lord of the Rings, even The Silmarillion. And I even have a copy of The Atlas of Middle-earth. I was into fantasy long before I became a communist. And I have to admit, like, it never really sat well with me. You know, you have, like, this scenario in, you know, like the Swarthy Hordes, you know, like this kind of thing, this kind of setup that Tolkien kind of does where, you know, you have, like, the Chosen Ones. They're kind of in Helm's Deep, or they're in kind of, like, some sort of fortification. And these screaming, savage, swarthy hordes of orcs come and attack them from all sides and stuff like that. It's almost like the apotheosis of, like, what the colonizer feels when he goes into, like, foreign lands, you know, and tries to take over, and he's fighting against all the natives and, like, massacring them and killing them and all this sort of stuff. But, you know, now, in this fantasy world, this alternate reality, like, these orcs are, like, you know, really brutal and, like, really servants of, like, a evil leader and this kind of stuff. You know, it's almost like, you know, it is like the encampment of the wagon train, you know, with the chosen people inside and the savages coming at them from outside. You know, like, this is the kind of scenario that Tolkien presents, and you can tell, you know, with this kind of setup, you know, he's obviously in a colonial society. He's in the middle of, like, the British Empire, and he's writing this. You know, and, you know, he's this Tory, this conservative, and, like, this is what the perspective he's writing from. And this is the stuff I grew up reading. But now that I am a communist and a budding fantasy writer, you know, I had to decide what my approach would be to this traditionally conservative literary genre. How to deal with the conventions of the genre while remaining true to myself and the socialist ideological and moral framework that I've committed myself to. You know, how do I do that? It was something I really had to think hard about, you know, even before I started writing my current novel back in 2016. And I ended up taking a lot of inspiration from the German communist poet and playwright Bertolt Brecht, and came to understand that a lot of his ideas about plays could be applied to writing fantasy, albeit in different ways. And I ended up writing an essay to myself entitled Take the Fight to Them, in an effort to clarify my position on being a radical fantasy writer and what that means. And, you know, I'm going to, you know, paraphrase parts of that essay, because I think it kind of illustrates kind of where I'm coming from. The essay starts out with a quote from George Habash, the founder of the Marxist-Leninist organization, the Popular Front for the Liberation of Palestine, PFLP, which has long struggled for the self-determination of the Palestinian people against the settler colonial state of Israel. And what George Habash says is this: in today's world, no one is innocent. No one a neutral. A man is either with the oppressed or he is with the oppressors. He who takes no interest in politics gives his blessing to the prevailing order, that of the ruling classes and exploiting forces. End quote. And George Habash ultimately would give his life, you know, for the struggle for the liberation of his people. This, in a nutshell, is the approach I take to writing fantasy novels. Even in the most gaudy fantasy world or far future society, if we're talking like science fiction, dialectics remain, and the battle between exploiters and exploited continues. Fantasy must not be about escapism. No imaginary world or idealistic mental playground can protect you from the reality of class struggle in this world. And the philosophy of take the fight to them aims to demolish all of these escapist cul-de-sacs fostered by advanced capitalism in this digital age of endless diversions and never-ending barrages of propaganda. Literature should inspire people to confront harsh and oppressive realities together. You know, confront harsh and oppressive realities together rather than encourage them to retreat from them alone, and to escape from them. You know, only in this way can the crippling atomization of life under advanced capitalism be overcome, and solidarity and collective empowerment constructed and built upon strong foundations that the capitalist state cannot destroy. And therefore, I believe that the class struggle must be brought into every medium of expression, every venue, every genre of literature, music, film, theater, even video games. The audience must be linked with real-world struggles and not cut off from them. And this was and remains central to the radical literary theory of alienation developed by Bertolt Brecht. You know, it's about bringing the real world into literature and communicating about real ideas, real conditions that people face. Brecht did not seek to immerse his audience in make-believe. He wanted them to see the bigger picture and the real issues at play without being sidetracked by the plot or fixated on the problems of individual characters. The focus was on the systemic issues and structures which ruled the characters' worlds and shaped their every action. I mean, really about the material conditions that the characters were dealing with. That's what the Brecht's plays are about. And this alienation effect, the distancing of the audience from the world of the characters so as to allow for critical thought and analysis about real-world issues, works perfectly with the themes of science fiction and fantasy, I think. I mean, fantasy in particular is ideal because the setting is so far removed from the world as we know it. You know, often set in like a completely different world, like a Middle Earth or something. You know, so far removed from the world as we know it, that the audience is capable of opening its mind to ideas that it might otherwise resist and to embrace a deeper point and message by doing so. The readers of fantasy are distanced from what is going on in the story. You know, they are not immersed in that environment, in their daily lives. You know, it's not part of their daily lives. So therefore, it becomes possible to make statements about the real world in fantasy. You know, make statements about contemporary politics and contemporary conflicts and social issues and economic issues and struggle that are much more subversive, provocative, and powerful than if they were made directly through political literature or some other medium of nonfiction. You know, so you can talk about radical themes in a fantasy world, and you can communicate that, I believe, in a very effective way. I mean, the rampant escapism and illusion that we see in the environment of late capitalist society, you know, where everything's for sale, you have commodification, advertisements are all over the place, you know, everybody wants to sell you something, everything is marketable. You know, you're supposed to sell yourself, market yourself in order to get a job, in order to get anything. You know, the rampant escapism when you try to get away from all that, I mean, you just get into another commodified reality of like some sort of TV show or movie or whatever. But the rampant escapism and illusion that we see in the environment of late capitalist society can only be combated by a continuous infusion of reality into fantasy. You know, smashing the barriers that the escapist tries to erect around them. You know, like a battering ram against a castle gate. Reality is radical amid this sea of lies and must be relentless enough to smash through all attempts to block it out. It follows that even the most outlandish science fiction and fantasy visions must make a strong political stance, you know, take a strong political stance about events and issues in the real world if they are to have any purpose and value beyond serving as safety valves for the status quo. You know, people can just go to when they're having a bad day. They can, you know, let their mind drift away into another world and forget about their life. You know, in the end, that doesn't really help anyone. In these genres, science fiction and fantasy, radical realism expresses itself through satire, by boldly turning convention on its head. A traditional fantasy writer glorifies the monarch and the aristocrat, you know, the elites, and encourages the, you know, working class person who's reading the book who's reading their book, their novel, to dream of riding alongside these gallant highborn heroes, or fantasize about standing in their finely made riding boots, knowing, you know, their power, their glory, and adventure, all of which contrasts so grandly with their mundane lives and struggles, day-to-day struggles. But the radical realist shatters these illusions by again and again exposing these feudal potentates for the monsters that they are, along with their brutal contempt for the common people that they live off of like parasites, you know, which of course is the reality of actual medieval feudalism. You know, there's nothing glamorous about it. And the radical realist does not allow a working class person to dream of anything but his or her own emancipation as a working class person, along with the true heroism that is inherent in the struggle, in that struggle for liberation, and in those who fight to see it realized. You know, this is proletarian literature with proletarian heroes who, though low-born, are more heroic and far more interesting than the grandest prince, king, or emperor. And Brecht himself was a master satirist of the capitalist society in which he lived, along with its literature. In his famous anti-war play, Mother Courage and Her Children, he makes the point that if ordinary people can only get by and survive in society through extraordinary virtues, it means that something is very wrong with how society is organized and with the forces and people that control it. And this is very familiar to us who live under the rubric of late capitalism in the dying embers of the post-war boom, you know. If you have to go crazy marketing yourself, presenting yourself, selling yourself, being a go-getter and a hustler, and displaying tremendous amounts of entrepreneurial talent just to get a steady job that pays the bills and provides for your family, then there's a serious problem with the society you're in. You know, in the context of 21st century late capitalism, ordinary is no longer enough, revealing a social order that is rotten to the core, where you basically have to be a hero just to survive. And it follows that the criticism that Brecht would no doubt make of a series like Game of Thrones is that it draws the reader to become emotionally attached to and invested in the fates of specific aristocratic characters, you know, elite characters that are competing for power or struggling to survive the power struggle they are caught up in as unwilling participants. Readers are encouraged to lose themselves in these vividly developed characters rather than critically examining and questioning the socio-political parameters of the world of Westeros as defined in deeply conservative terms by George R.R. Martin. Readers are ruled by their emotions. They're encouraged to be ruled by their emotions and driven by their subconscious, you know, immersing themselves in the story rather than standing back and critically analyzing its implications. Thus, they do not ask questions like, why do the ordinary people of Westeros put up with the aristocratic feuds that are destroying their livelihoods and tearing their land apart? Why do they tolerate this parasitical feudal order, which is so clearly built upon exploitation and abuse? Why do the low-born not rise up and become active agents of their own destiny and take control of society for themselves? Why are there no peasant revolts, urban uprisings, or township rebellions, which were all common features of feudal societies, you know, in Europe and the world over? I mean, George R.R. Martin's decision to keep the common people in his novels passive, you know, and atomized, almost reminds me of Margaret Thatcher's statement that there is, you know, no such thing as society. There are only individuals and their families. Indeed, much of Game of Thrones reads almost like a celebrity gossip column, in essence, you know, who's sleeping with who, and who is so-and-so's child. I'm not surprised that modern-day consumers of Hollywood, celebrity, royal soap operas, and tabloids find George R.R. Martin's work to be very juicy indeed, you know. You know, it's a grotesque caricature, and yet another feature that firmly places Martin in the literary landscape of late capitalism, where reality is distorted beyond recognition in the service of the profit motive. You know, the common people in his stories are effectively at the mercy of the aristocrats and are given no agency or collective interest at all. Historical examples of the common people taking their destiny into their own hands, such as the English Peasants' Revolt, the Hussite Rebellion, was now the Czech Republic, the German Peasants' War, and similar popular uprisings by the lower orders, have no place in the world of Westeros, you know, in the world of Game of Thrones, where non-aristocrats are quite openly reduced to the status of pawns and onlookers in these power games that the aristocrats are engaged in, these great aristocratic houses. You know, like the Lannisters and the Starks and the Targaryens and all that. I mean, this is hardly a progressive literary vision. You know, and yet Martin's working class readers seem to have not yet learned to ask questions about it. But as the 21st century marches on, as time marches on, even the most, you know, and we get into more economic crises and like it becomes even harder to hold down a job. It becomes even, you know, you're working harder and harder for less and less. You know, wages are not keeping up the cost of living and all this, you know, and social services are degrading and education becomes more costly and all that. You know, as this keeps going, even the most escapist members of the working class are discovering that they have nowhere to run. In this age of austerity, war, and environmental catastrophe, it is increasingly becoming clear, you know, for the sake of self-preservation, that they must fight against their oppressors and exploiters. Not only must they fight, they must know what it means to fight. And this is where mainstream literature and media in general has really failed working class people. You know, fantasy in particular has blinded them. You know, mainstream fantasy and science fiction have blinded them to the reality with regard to the nature of struggle, the nature of sacrifice, the nature of heroism, the nature of victory, and above all, the true nature of good and evil. I mean, to draw upon the example of Tolkien's The Hobbit and The Lord of the Rings, if the evil forces of Middle-earth are so dangerous, if Sauron is so dangerous, if Smaug is so dangerous, and if the forces of good and righteousness are truly beset from all sides, you know, like a wagon train, you know, and facing destruction, then how is it that Tolkien's heroes can hack their way through legions of orcs, goblins, Easterlings, Southrons, you know, like there's the swarthy hordes right there, you know, once again, the colonial attitudes in Tolkien, Dunlendings and Nazgul, often without taking a single casualty? How can they do that? You know, there's no historical example from the Palestinian liberation struggle to the Cuban Revolution, all the way going back to Spartacus' slave rebellion in ancient Rome, to say nothing of the Soviet Union's exceptionally bloody and heroic struggle against Nazi Germany. There's no example of a besieged people challenging a mighty and evil empire without paying the cost in blood. And yet the ultimate sacrifices made by the protagonists in Middle-earth are very, very small when it comes down to it. I mean, who dies of the main characters? Virtually no one. Like Boromir, he's the only one who dies. Out of the original fellowship, no one else bites the dust. Out of the entire course, even after going through all this hardship, you know, this massive quest against these mortal enemies, mortal threats, Boromir is the only one who dies. And in the real world, heroes die and good guys bleed. Evil is never defeated without the ability to sacrifice and the willingness to suffer, take casualties, and accept death. And it's the harsh reality of it. I mean, think of how many Vietnamese people died in resistance to the U.S. Army in Vietnam, you know, to kick that army out of that country. You know, over more like a decade of struggle, you know, just the most, you know, heavy, most total warfare you can imagine. How many of them died? You know, millions to make that liberation possible. I mean, Hollywood, like most bourgeois cultural institutions, teaches people that it is possible for, you know, the chosen few, the chosen people, to win without real cost and to enjoy the fruits of victory without suffering. You know, thus it stands in total defiance of reality. You know, in fact, that seems to be the whole point of all these superhero movies that you see these days. about these superhuman chosen few who are going to get by, not through actual, organizing, struggle, mobilization of the masses and all that. They're just going to do it by like these superhuman powers that makes them effectively invulnerable. And they can do all kinds of stuff. And ultimately, they can walk away in the end victorious. And yeah. And they're just like this small handful of chosen people. That's how, these are the ones who achieve victory. Now, real suffering and real victories are to be found in the USSR's life and death struggle against Hitler's legions, against Nazi Germany, between 1941 and 1945. Real heroes are people like the female Soviet bomber pilot, Yevgenia Zigulenko, who flew 968 low-level night bombing missions against Nazi troops in World War II, sometimes operating, 10 to 15 sorties per night in an open cockpit light bomber aircraft, and was twice shot down and multiple times nearly killed. And she saw plenty of her comrades die around her. Such true heroes are far more real than Tolkien's literary and movie portrayals of Aragorn, who can wade through all the dangers of The Lord of the Rings without suffering so much as a scratch. True heroes are not chosen ones, but ordinary people responding, with all their fears and imperfections and hang-ups to extraordinary circumstances and terrifying circumstances. It is therefore vital that working class and oppressed people see themselves in science fiction and fantasy literature. And furthermore, the people writing science fiction and fantasy understand real history and how radical real history is. And for science fiction and fantasy literature, for this literature to show working class and oppressed people that real victories can be won, no matter how hard the struggle might be. And it's not enough for this literature to criticize and satirize the status quo. This literature must always involve the struggle for power and the seizure of power by working class and oppressed people. Regardless of the world that it's set in, whether that's a far distant planet or like some mythical world or like, fantasy world that's totally made up, these dynamics are still there. They still have to be there. They still have to be dealt with because this is reality. This is the reality of the real world. Unless you're engaged in like complete escapism, in which you're, as far as I'm concerned, your work is next to useless when it comes to real people. You have to confront these things. This literature, science fiction and fantasy, it should include a strong sense of historical memory on the part of the oppressed. And a repressed yet still burning desire for vengeance against their oppressors on behalf of present and past generations, in addition to yearning for redemption on the part of future generations. And self-determination and the struggle for self-determination must underpin everything in this literature. And anyone who would write this literature must have respect for the real-world struggles of those resisting capitalism, colonialism, and empire around the world. Anything less, as George Habash of the Popular Front for the Liberation of Palestine rightly pointed out, would be submission to the forces of exploitation and oppression, which are tearing the world apart as we speak. Reality is radical. Reality is struggle. It's a struggle. And this must permeate any world that an author would create, along with the hard-fought victories that can and must be won in the name of the just and livable future that we all strive for as progressive-minded people. In the end, writing is never non-political. Please stay tuned to Back in the USSR.
When I feel alone, I sing. Happy birthday to me. Today is my birthday. No, not today is the day of my birth, but today is the day of my rebirth, because every day that I do this poem, I reemerge from within this womb of myself, and I'm alone. The same way I'm going to die. Alone. But hopefully, not lonely. See, I want the few who do and will know me to know that life knew how to hold me and that I died in her arms right where I belonged. Embracing, discovering every fold of skin one can get lost in the cost is, I will have to do it alone. The same way we all dream. And really, would it be any clearer if I said God wrote a letter saying truth is, Deanna, I gotta go. Because there's over 7 billion people that need directions or a miracle, and that's only on this earth. And what about the universe and the unimaginable amount of animals you could imagine don't believe in me? And there's a million more forests that need more rings, because life is getting engaged to trees. And there's 200,000 more leagues into the sea that I got to keep a secret. Because honestly, I see you all as destructive creatures. And there's plants I got to protect so this world will have what it needs to heal it. I am not forsaking you. No, I am not your father whose heart will be in heaven. Hollow be thy silent shame. I'm just leaving you my spirit and free will, understanding there'll be days you curse my name. So you take care while I'm gone. Find my voice and yours to keep you strong, and I'll leave your life with teachers who will inspire you and remind you of what I can do, and that words are more than a sound or sounds forming meaningful elements of speech. They are powerful tools to reach those like you who are of this state of solitude, a place where when you blink, it's just you behind the eyelids. If I said this, would that help you to get this message that life is a revolving door system? You're born alone. You struggle to connect because this life hurts. It hurts like being considered 3/5 of a human being. Tattooed identification, deaf ears, and assassinations. Like bloody broom handles. Like empty yet distended stomachs. Like emptied, then reloaded. Then reloaded. Then reloaded clips. Like unsolicited long journeys. And goodbyes. Like concrete beds and cardboard sheets, like ghettos, like glue in paper bag, track marks, stray bullets and landmines. The Willie Lynch plan, like being orphaned, like women and children being raped, like land being auctioned, having to sell yourself, like closets and hate. This life hurts like a broken heart. And then you die alone. Sound about right? Who here hasn't caught themselves asking, God, what's your problem? Why are we faced with such plights? But there is no reply. Because he knows that we know that if we are to keep this communication through the darkness, it's going to come through continuous communication and unity equaling community. Mesh fingers, rallies, and sincere apologies. Do head bobs, hugs, and how was your days? Do I love yous? Sun settings and smiles. Do hope. And the end will justify the means if you, if I, can echo, you are not alone, alone. To your reflection and mean it. Don't you agree? Don't you want to be a part of something, fit in somewhere not inside the box or on the fence, but somewhere in between? If so, when you feel alone, sing. Happy birthday to me. With me. Because to die alone could be done with ease, but to live together requires work. Work that cannot be done alone.
Thank you for listening to Back in the USSR, brothers and sisters. That was Truth Is, one of my favorite spoken word poets of all time, capturing a lot of the themes I've been talking about in this episode tonight in that wonderful poem entitled Alone. And of course, you know, that last sentence, you know, that she has there in that poem, you know, to die alone can be done with ease, but to live together requires work. Work that cannot be done alone. And like I say, I think that poem captures a lot of what I've really been talking about here when I talk about the fantasy genre, when I talk about the literature which I'm trying to write here, you know, trying to capture in some ways these real world struggles I see going on, like by, you know, as working class and oppressed people rise up and they fight against exploitation, they fight against oppression, and they join hand in hand, they join together, and they win real victories. Like through their efforts, you know, even though the road is long and hard and bloody, they still do it. Like they're still fighting. And that's what I try to capture in what I write. And this has not been what the fantasy genre has been about. You know, it's not been about the struggles of oppressed people. It hasn't captured that real history and the ongoing reality of class struggle in the world today and throughout history. You know, it hasn't really captured that. You know, it's, like I say, fantasy has traditionally been a very conservative genre. You know, this genre I've chosen to write in, and it's a challenge to write in and, you know, push the envelope, push the conventions, do all this kind of stuff, and also, you know, hope to get published in the end. You know, like, this is a very challenging thing. And I don't know, obviously, where this work is going to go. All I know is I've reached the second draft, which, I mean, that's pretty good for first-time authors. I've, like, almost finished the second draft. You know, so the book is there. You know, I actually have something concrete to show for my efforts. And this is what I got to work with. And you know, the ideas I'm trying to communicate in the book might not be palatable to some people, maybe some editors, some publishers, and this kind of stuff, given the kind of subject matter I'm dealing with, radical subject matter. But I believe it would be a disservice for me, disservice to the readers, if I didn't look at this stuff. And if I just indulge in escapism, I mean, if you want escapism, just go to Netflix, you know? Why the hell do you need to read my book if you want to just escape from reality and just zone out, you know? If you're going to read my book, I'm going to give you something meaningful. Something that at least is going to, you can read and then take away something, some inspiration, like understand the world around you some more. And the real struggles that you see around you and realize that this is going on, like, right before your eyes. You know, if I can communicate these things through that medium, through this fantasy medium that other people might not easily embrace, given what they've, you know, the kind of attitudes they've been taught to embrace in this society. You know, if I can communicate more radical stuff to them through this these fantasy worlds that I've created, so when they come back, they read this book and they come back into the real world and it's like, okay, they're willing to consider more radical like ideas and approaches and things like that, you know, than they would have before. I would have done my job then. I would have been able to, you know, communicate these ideas and this sort of thing using this medium and reaching more people than maybe otherwise would have with this stuff. So this is the first of two episodes where I'll be discussing radical fiction. Next week, I'll focus a little more on my own writing and experience with my own work. While continuing to expand on this discussion, you know. So this is part one of two. And I want to say, take care, comrades and friends, and I hope you'll join me. I'm back in the USSR on CFRU 93.3 FM this time next week for more. Thank you very much again.
attracting masses. I'm redrafting the battle map set off of task list. I build a classic boom bap blast, bazooka rap shit. I'm sending heads into backspin, attack with wind at the back, plus vernaculars to dig it back by facts. Packed with the stat charts and graphs, I got passion.